Hello, and welcome to the ECE Quality Ireland podcast. I'm Paula Walsh, and you might notice that another voice that's usually with me is missing this week. So this week, we're sharing something slightly different with you. This week, Celine spoke to Simon Lewis on his podcast called If I Were the Minister for Education. Simon is a primary school principal, and he invited Celine on to talk about the early childhood education sectors. So they spoke about similarities and differences between primary school and early childhood. They spoke about the rollout and implementation of ASHTER and the difference in how it was adopted in primary school and by primary school junior and senior infant teachers and in early childhood settings. They also spoke about some of the issues around that. And another interesting topic they spoke about was the transition for children into primary school. And they considered whether or not perhaps early childhood settings should retain children up to 6 years old. And then those children perhaps could transition into primary school and start primary school at 7 years old in first class as the first class. So I'd like to thank Simon for letting us share this podcast on our platform. And we're going to share that with you now. And I really hope you enjoy it. There's lots of really interesting discussion from two professionals in both, you know, who have a lot of knowledge in both their sectors. And we hope to have you tune in again for future episodes of the ECE Quality Ireland podcast.
Early Childhood Education, an interview with Celine Govern. As many listeners will know, at this time of recording, which is the summer of 2022, early childhood education has been in the media, mainly because of the rising costs of the service for families, but also a chronic shortage of staff and many classes not being able to open. OnChild.net is obviously interested in the world of primary education, but before children come to us, they obviously have a few years of preschool. And I was interested in how the two of them link. I've often argued that the infant's education should become part of preschool rather than primary school. And I was interested in maybe the thoughts of somebody or some people around this area in early childhood education and to learn a little more about the sector and how it works. I was lucky to be joined by Celine Govern, who is a early childhood educator provider and is also a secondary school teacher and a podcaster. So very interested to hear about those. I hope you'll enjoy this chat that I've had with Celine, where we talk about the early childhood sector, the links between preschool, primary school and even secondary school, and lots more to do with early childhood education. And obviously, at the very end, like everyone else, Celine shares with us what she would do if she were the Minister for Education. Hello, hello. You are welcome to If I Were the Minister for Education from OnShaw.net. This is Simon Lewis. As you may have been listening in the media for the last little while, there's been a lot of talk about early childhood education, the cost of it, how it works and so on. And I kind of thought it might be a good idea to chat to someone who actually provides early childhood education. So I'm really, really happy this week to be joined by Celine Govern, who is an early years provider, but also a podcaster. So we'll be talking about both of those things. As well as that, Celine is a secondary school teacher and actually teaches in a Leaving Cert Applied course in early childhood education. And I'd be really interested in hearing about that. So we might talk on lots and lots of different areas. Celine, it's fantastic to meet you, and thanks for coming on the show.
Thanks, Simon. Absolutely delighted that you asked me on and that you allow me to speak about my passions freely without having to say, sorry, I'm talking too much again. But I'm delighted to come in and talk, and I think it'll be a really interesting conversation.
Absolutely. And I'm looking forward to it. So I always start off with the first question anybody asks someone in an interview, but it's not an interview. But you might tell us a little bit about yourself and how you have gotten into the area of early childhood education, but also second level and even the world of podcasting.
Yeah. So not a traditional route at all. So I would have gone to school. I grew up in Dublin and went to school in Colosh-Debrie and Clondalkin, where I now teach, and did my leaving cert in 1990 and took the traditional route that most of us were taking, which was secretarial courses and into administration office work. So for 10 years or so, I worked in insurance, basically, for some of the big Irish insurance companies. And coming up then to, I suppose, I got married and had my eldest. And he started his early years preschool journey. And I think I just, we moved house at the same time. And the house that we moved from rural Ireland into a village, onto the main street of a village. And a very old big house with very old big stables. And I was looking at what my son was experiencing in the early years sector. And it was as easy, as simple as kind of saying, God, I like that, you know, that interests me. And I suppose for the first time, I found something that actually I was passionate about and I couldn't stop thinking about it. I didn't feel like that about insurance, do you know? I started to investigate it and to see, was this something that I could do? And it turned out it was. So we, over the course of 2 years and two further babies, I demolished the stables and rebuilt. And so I built a purpose-built school. Wow. And that opened 20 years ago this September. Wow. So went into it very, very green. It was only after I decided to do this that I thought I better get a qualification. So I did, and I got what was then the equivalent of a level 5. It was the old NCVA level 2, which was then converted into level 5. So, and off we went. Wow. Myself and another teacher who is still with me and still works with me. She's now my manager and or our manager. It's not, you know, I don't feel like it's mine as such. It's a community. You know, it is. I own it, I suppose, but I don't feel that type of personal ownership on it. So she's still with me and we have grown and built on another room since and all became highly qualified and experienced. And 20 years on, I'm still here. In the meantime, in the middle of all of this, as you will find out very quick if you work in the sector, it's extremely difficult to make a living in the sector. Extremely difficult, especially when you are operating a preschool. Sure. So I decided I wanted to become a teacher, you know, God forgive me, but like a proper teacher, which was what people thought. Which was 15 years ago, to my eternal shame, I know I thought that. And people always say to me, but why did you go secondary school and not primary school? And I suppose the reason is at the time I was doing a huge amount of volunteering with teenagers in the Girl Guides of Ireland and also in the marching youth band sector. So I was working with an awful lot of teenagers from Talla, where I was originally from, and I just loved it. And I also loved history, and I, you know, so I wanted to be a history teacher. So I went back, and I'm a Mater Dei graduate. I graduated in 2011.
Very good.
So I juggled all of these things at the same time while commuting to Dublin. And that lady who I spoke about kind of held the fort during all of that, and then I managed it all from a distance. So yeah, I'm back in Colosh-Debrie. I job share and my subjects are religion and history. And I also teach all of the childcare on the LCA program, which is fabulous. So that's how I am doing a mad variety of things, really.
You're very busy, which is
extremely.
Yeah, very, very busy. One of the things that when we were talking before, we actually started talking on Twitter, as where all good conversations begin, I would argue. But you mentioned, which I thought was really interesting, that in your own preschool, you haven't adopted a particular model of childcare, which I thought was really interesting. My mum was ran a preschool with her friends in the early 90s, when I don't think the industry was very well developed, but I don't think they would have even known what a model was. They were looking after children, they were playing, and that's essentially what they were doing. But I assume, given that you have the knowledge of the area much more than my mum would have done, firstly, like what models are there in preschool? I mean, many people listening to this will know about primary school and the differences between primary schools and even secondary schools. But people have heard of Montessori. They'll have heard of, potentially other models. But what models are there? And then why did you decide not to choose one?
Yeah, there are any amount of models. I'd say there are hundreds, if not more, models throughout the world. And some of them will be very regional and they will have been developed because of the context of a particular environment, etc. But some of the ones that we're most familiar with, of course, Montessori is there. And certainly in the early 1990s, there were, although your mum didn't, but there were St. Nicholas Montessori College in Dunleary, I think, would have been there. And there were people who were specialising in Montessori, and it would have been the most popular one back then. But then there's also, you know, Froebel, and the degree in Maynooth, actually, in early years education is considered a Froebel degree. Mm. You've got Steiner as well. High Scope, which kind of came out of America, I think. The Forest School approach now, which, of course, is very common in other countries and is becoming more common in Ireland. Mm. And one, I suppose if I was to say, you know, if somebody was to pin me down and say, you know, give us an approach. And sometimes actually we get this when we're answering questionnaires for the department. You know, they insist that you give them a model.
Yeah, yeah.
And I suppose I would go with the Reggio Emilia model if I'm pushed to the pin of my collar. Okay. But I did a podcast on this recently with Paula Walsh, who I podcast with. And it stemmed from a conversation that I had with my son, who is currently going through the level five. Mm. And I would be very resistant to a lot of the models in their entirety. But I'm very open to elements from all models. So yes. He would come home each, you know, week and say, yeah, I think we're doing an awful lot of Montessori. I'd say, go way out of that. No, we're not. Absolutely not. And then he'd say, we're doing a lot of Froebel. And I'd be like, well, I can see there's a bit of Froebel there. All right. And, you know, and it really, and then he said, which I thought was genius, would any school align themselves to one model when they have 22 different individuals in the one room?
Yeah.
Surely what we should be doing is knowing and understanding all of the models and adapting a model depending on the child or the children in the classroom. So he was saying every classroom should have every model, or else how is it working? Wow. You know, so we did a whole podcast on this because I was just blown away by the whole thing.
Wow. And but while we are talking about your podcast, where can people find that podcast? I'll be asking this at the end as well, but now this is in my mind.
So through myself and Paula Walsh, who is the digital educator, Paula has years experience in the early years sector as well, actually in an outdoor school, and she now lectures, and actually she's starting her PhD in September, which is wonderful. So we are on Twitter under ECE Quality Ireland, and our podcast is also available on Podbean, but you'll find the link for it on our Twitter page. Brilliant. And you can go via me either on my Twitter page or Instagram page, but we'll put all them up at the end.
Fantastic.
So, yeah, so look at different people align themselves to different models, and then some people align themselves to no model apart from a play-based model, which is what I do. And I suppose it was the emphasis on play, and is the reason why I didn't align myself to one particular model as such. Mm. I suppose when you watch children and you observe children, you really can see the benefit of play. And you can see this in your own home or in the playground. But, you know, when you're observing in the early years, the importance of play to a child's development is just so apparent, you know.
Yes.
And I don't like anything that takes children away from their play. I don't like anything that disturbs a child's play. Mm. I don't like anything that's so teacher-led or teacher-led at all that says, you know, I'm delighted you played with that for 5 minutes, but now you have to stop because I, as the adult, have decided that it's circle time.
Yes.
That, you know, so I suppose I am just, maybe I'm a bit of a rebel. And I know in the early days when we used to have the old HSE inspections, which are now TUSLA inspections, they would have fought with me a little bit over this, you know. Okay. Why are you not doing Montessori, or you know, would you not, or you know, and it actually was written on a report.
Interesting.
And yeah, and I really fought hard, and I said, well, because I, first of all, you know, they're not me. You know, you're asking me to teach something that I fundamentally disagree with, and I don't think it's developmentally appropriate for our children. Now, you know, what I do, which is what I've always done in my early years setting, is up there on a pedestal.
Yes.
Best practice. So yes. Maybe I was just ahead of my time.
Ahead of your time. And do you think that there's we do this at primary level, that we sort of align ourselves to a model? And maybe that happens, you know, I can't speak outside of my own sector, but it does that seem to be where the pressure is coming from, rather than it being a good idea? You know, sometimes it's actually okay not to have to align with it.
And there's societal pressure there as well, isn't there? You know, so, you know, over the years, I would have had people who, you know, came to me, sent their child to me for year one, and then took them from me and sent them to a Montessori for year two. You know, and you as a professional know exactly what's going on in that Montessori. Poor Fred, but God almighty, Montessori teachers are going to go mental. I don't mean I'm just using it as an example. Send them to another type of model because for some reason they feel that that's superior. Yes. And that's all societal pressure.
I get that.
Sat in that classroom for a year and can see what's going on. Do you know what I mean? So a lot of that is societal pressure, but we do align ourselves to approach. And the problem for me is that if you, and we know best practice is to have a child-led approach, if the adult in the room aligns themselves to one approach, then they are telling their staff and their teachers that this is the approach, and then they are telling their children that this is the approach. And I don't see how that's child-led.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. It's funny, the fashions almost that to change. Like at the moment, the forest approach is a fashionable thing, possibly because, you know, all the tech giants are sending all their preschoolers, or you know, that kind of stuff. Yeah. But anyway, I'm falling out now with all the people sending their kids to forest. So we both
basically means you go outside.
Yeah, that's the thing. I know. It's funny. But don't tell them that. It's far superior.
Well, you know what? We're all doing the same thing, and we all want what's best for children.
Exactly.
And, you know, we're outside all the time, and I have a wonderful outdoor setting. And you know, I suppose, and I take, you know, I'm also a lot of forest. We do an awful lot of forest school. We you know, and I do an awful lot of research, and I take an awful lot of what they do. So, again, it's like, you know, I definitely do Montessori for the children who thrive on that. Definitely do forest for the children who thrive on that. I definitely have Frebel's kindergarten for the children who thrive on that. And in fact, they can cross models constantly all day.
Yeah.
So, you know, that's my model. What's your model, Celine? My model is all of the models.
Very good. And I mean, with the thing that ties that all together is play, as you were saying, is not it? And one of the things, I suppose, in the primary sector right now is that finally, at primary level, we're recognising that play is central to infant education, and rightly so. Mm-hmm. And we've taken, and 10 years ago, I think it's 10 years ago, that Ashter was born.
2009,
Is it 2009? So gosh, it's more. I remember... I remember that was released. It sounded really exciting, and then the teachers took it and ruined it, as far as I could see. I mean, when I say the teachers, I don't mean people on the ground particularly, but by the time it filtered to teachers, it had just been ripped apart. You know, that there was these things like, this is only an hour a day, or this is, you know, this kind of stuff, and it really, I know it really annoyed Noreen McLaughlin, I think, Noreen Hayes, whoever Noreen McLaughlin is, I was not wrongly name checking, but Noreen Hayes, I know that really annoyed her too.
Yeah.
Like what do you think of Ashter now, 15 years later? Is it worth anything, or is it just, do you need to rip it up and start again?
Yeah, as you said, Ashter was launched in 2009 by the NCCA, which is the National Council for Curriculum and Assessment. And it was launched, and Noreen Hayes was heavily involved, who is a genius and really understands the sector really comprehensively well.
Yeah.
So there is nothing wrong with the ASHTR framework. And the ASHTR is not a curriculum. ASHTR is a framework.
Yes.
That everything else can slot into.
Mm.
The delivery of it and how it was rolled out was appalling across the early years and primary school sector.
Okay.
I had one training session on it. I was brought to the Ardboyne Hotel in Navan, where the poor divils who were delivering it knew less than I did.
Yeah.
They didn't, you know, we came away from it and I was meant to go back and deliver this then to my staff. And it just was really, really, really poorly done. Now, ASHTR now is undergoing review.
Mm.
So the whole thing is now being reassessed. Yeah, there are, and I think I listened to your podcast on this some time ago, and you made the point that it appears that preschools have embraced it better, I suppose, is better the word, more appropriately than primary schools. And of course, there's lots of reasons for that. Primary schools are burdened with their curriculum. You know, did somebody say 11 subjects?
Yeah, yeah.
For infants, Lord above.
you know.
And then I thought about it today and I thought, God, I was going 11 subjects. And then I thought, but you were doing 11 subjects.
Okay.
When I think about it, I just don't find the time. I don't timetable it all out. Do you know what I mean?
Yes, yes.
But do I touch English, Irish, maths, history, geography, science, art, home ec? Of course I do. Of course I do. All within the ASHTR framework. I often hear, and as you said in primary school, the phrase, when in the day, this is all on Instagram, you know, people asking other people questions. When do you do ASHTR?
Yeah.
During the day? You know, how long do you do ASHTR for?
Mm.
What do you do in ASHTR? And I want to scream and say, if you're doing ASHTR, you've lost. You're wrong. Stop. Yeah, step back.
Yeah.
And ask somebody who incorporates ASHTR and links it in. And there are amazing primary school infant teachers who are doing this and are so willing to help. ASHTR in Action on Instagram, and Dee, I think she's Playful Classroom, amazing work going on where ASHTR is being used correctly.
But yeah.
And when I speak to some of the primary school teachers and I say, what do you mean you're doing it for an hour or you're doing it for half an hour? You know, their classrooms aren't set up for this.
No.
That's the reality. You know, there's you shouldn't have to leave your classroom to go into an ASHTR classroom.
Exactly.
Then you're doing it, aren't you? It's like going to PE.
Going to PE or going to the computer room, that kind of stuff. Yeah.
So, you know, there are lots of barriers there. I was at the NCN conference a couple of months ago, National Childhood Network, and the two of the ladies, they were ladies, who are involved in the ASHTR review were there. And it was wonderful to hear the amazing work that's been going on. And one of the things that they said they feel was really, really important is that there is cross-sector in-service training should be offered for preschool teachers and infant teachers in terms of ASHTR.
Okay.
So that we can communicate and work together and that there is an easier transition. You know, the problem with that, of course, is that when you're in the early years sector, there's no funding for in-service training. You know, you can't get time off. You have to do it in your own time, which they do. Would you mean the preschool teachers can say, well, I can do it at 6 o'clock at night. And, you know, those of us in the public sector are going, you must be joking.
I know.
You know, so there is, of course, all those barriers again that need to be met. But yeah, ASHTR is a good framework. There's nothing wrong with it. It's going through a review because it's so old now and you have to keep reviewing things and changing it. The implementation of it has been appalling.
Yeah.
Not just in the primary school sector. There are certainly still, I would say, earlier years classrooms that still struggle with it.
Okay. That's interesting to know. I mean, I was so annoyed when it came into, because I remember I think it was a victim of the recession in some ways, the training, because we were there was no way they were going to be able to roll it out properly in terms of professional development. So it nearly became a drip feeding sort of thing that people like me got an hour's talk at a conference, and then I was to then drip feed that back to my staff with no knowledge of early childhood properly. I mean, proper education, but Yeah, and I think it was no surprise that, you know, and I mean, it's not the only thing that that happens. I presume, again, it's not just a primary school thing, that an idea comes or a theory comes or a something comes in or a framework comes in, and then teachers, rather than adopt it, adapt it. And sometimes it gets adapted very bad. But I think Asha was possibly the most extreme that I've ever experienced. And yeah. Some of it, in fairness, I put down to the fact that CPD was just non-existent because there was no money, and really everyone had to kind of just figure it out for themselves. And it was almost like by consensus, it became a subject, which was, you know, and then once it was there, that was the end of it, really, as far as it becomes. It's now like station teaching now, which is it's amazing. I see it.
Going to the gym.
What's that?
Like going to the gym and you go around the stations.
Exactly. And children go to this place on a Monday, this place on a Tuesday. So it's no longer play-based. It's
no, of course it's not. Yeah. And they're also not making their own decisions. I mean, what happens if the child, for example, got really engrossed in a game on the Monday in Home Corner, for example?
Yeah.
And they thought about that all night. And they went home and they spoke to their parents about it. And this is what I was doing. And I was playing with little John and we were making a cake. And they thought about it. And then they go in the next day and they're not allowed to continue that learning because now you're a vet.
Yeah, exactly.
or whatever it is. And I do think practically the CPD has to be undertaken with junior and senior infant teachers in terms of how children learn through play. And, you know, it is a very specialised area. Mm. And, you know, I also have a degree in early childhood education. So, you know, I understand how children learn. And I think the practicalities of, well, how do I teach a maths concept through the framework of ASHTR?
Okay. Yeah.
And, you know, there are numerous ways to teach a maths concept. They don't have to be sitting at a table on a chair looking at a whiteboard. Yeah. And, you know, and we're into teacher exposition then, you know, of course they can learn those concepts. But if teachers are coming out of college or teachers have been out of college for a long time and they've never been shown practically how to do that and what are the strategies and what are the resources and how can I actually do this, you know, well, then it's going to continue. We're going to continue teaching toddlers.
Exactly.
Toddlers. Is what they are, as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, and it's really interesting that you give maths as the example, because I've been interested. I've been talking to teachers about the infant, the early maths curriculum in infant, and there's again a bit of a consensus. I mean, I'm only talking about people I'm really speaking to, that it's too easy, and we should be pushing the children harder on it, and I didn't really think about it too much until you just mentioned that. But the thing is, there's a reason why it's at a particular level, because we need to be, in order to get a good foundation in early mathematical activities and things like that, you need to do, it's not about teaching it actually, it's that children have to discover it, right? You know, through play, and get, and that's why you're not going beyond, let's say, the number 10, or you're doing so much sorting and matching and all the rest of it, all those really important skills. Because if you don't do enough of that and discover it and play and all through play, when you come to actually formal mathematical education, if you don't have the foundation, it's like building a house. You're going to be a definite disadvantage. And you I don't know. Maybe I'm talking nonsense there, but that's.
No, I mean, I think the scaffolding is so important, isn't it? Mm. And you know, I don't know much about. I'm not going to pretend I know anything really about the primary school curriculum, you know, but in terms of maths and junior infants, you know, is it a defined thing they have to know A, B and C or 1, 2 and 3 by the end of junior infants? Like, is that very clearly defined? Are teachers under that pressure?
I would think so. I mean, I think there's a couple of problems there. Like, primary schools are still very heavily book dependent, and that's you know, obviously flies in the face of, for me anyway, of any early education. But as well as that, yeah, the curriculum up to you know, in infant level does have, you know, this early mathematical activities, but that's only like a bit of the maths curriculum. Yeah. Now, I know it's going to change in 2026, but will our mindsets change before 2026? I don't think so. And I guess, you know, and maths is a worrying one, really. I think, I mean, there's a lot, every subject's worrying in its own way. Yeah. But given the importance of mathematics, let's say, for and how we use mathematics in this century rather than the last couple of centuries, it has to be more based on real things rather than these abstract concepts that nobody really cares about. So I don't know. However, on the other side of things, because I'm going to move to your other job, the secondary school teacher job, secondary school teachers are always giving out to us about maths that we don't teach them well enough.
But, don't teach maths.
I know you don't, but it gives me a good segue into getting you into wearing your secondary school hat. But I'm really interested in the fact, and the question's in two parts. What I'm in primary school, and you're sort of sandwiched between your two levels of expertise, and I'm always fascinated by the links between them because I think they're very badly linked. From two sides, as an early years person, what do you think primary schools should do better that we can link, that we can get the links better between preschool and primary? And then on the other side of it, what could we do better at primary in order to, I always joke and say we survive secondary school, really, but you're a secondary school teacher, so I'm going to be nice and say, well, what could we do better in primary school to kind of get to secondary school in a good way? Or are we doing things right? I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, transitions are very important, and they're important every day, but then those huge transitions between the different sectors, you know. And, you know, you often see a huge amount of anxiety and stress when children realise that they have to, and this, that they have to move, you know, and that they have to leave where they feel safe and secure. And that happens between preschool and primary, and also between primary and secondary. Not for all children. Some children transition seamlessly. Yeah. But, you know, a lot of children don't. And are there things that we can do? Absolutely. I do worry about the schoolification of children.
Okay.
I do worry that, you know, in the preschool sector, that there is still a belief amongst certain preschool teachers and primary school teachers that we should be getting them ready for school. And no, we should not.
Yes. Good.
We should absolutely not be getting children. It is not the children's job to be ready for the next stage of education. It is their job to be ready for the children.
Yes.
And I believe that we need to meet the children where they are at their stage of development. Not where we believe their stage of development should be, but where it truly is. And, you know, I don't mind saying that in 20 years, I have never had a primary school teacher contact me and say, can I come in and visit the children?
Really?
Who are coming to me. The expectation is that I will bring them to them.
Wow. I'm surprised because we do the opposite where I am.
That's a huge amount of organisation for me to get 20 children ready to parade up the road, or if they're going to schools outside of, you know, where you have to go. You know, so I've kind of put the foot down a little bit with it.
Yeah.
I would be over the moon to welcome in an infant teacher to come in and see them in their environment and let the children show the teacher what they do, where they like to play, how they learn, you know, what the environment structurally looks like, feels like, smells like, how it works.
Yes.
And only then, I think, can the junior infant teacher really have a feel for what they are getting in September. Because they're coming in September, and I think sometimes there is an expectation, you know, that they're just going to come in and that they're going to understand how it all works.
Yeah.
You know, and in the first week it's not working. But sure, we're not surprised.
Yeah, of course it isn't.
You know, so I think that's the first thing. I think that we really need to see the children and listen to their voice in terms of where they are, not where we need them to be. But I think that kind of carries on a little bit then. And it's exactly the same thing, isn't it? It's all about where are they, not where I want them to be in first year. I haven't been a first year tutor in quite a while. It's probably 6 years ago because it takes you follow with them.
Sure.
And you know, they come in and we just... Now, I have to say, some secondary schools do this really, really well, and we are one of those schools who do it really, really well. Yeah. And there's a whole transition program, you know, and there's lots of mentoring with TY students who meet them and bring them everywhere. And, you know, they've mentoring groups and lunchtime groups and all that. That goes on all year, actually, the lunchtime group. Yeah. Where they can go in if they have a difficulty with a concept and, you know, some of the older students who are really good at something. So I think bringing the older children into that journey, you know, to bring them in. But yeah, I do think that first year tutors need to make that journey into the primary school classroom.
Yeah, and I think, well, I mean, again, I don't know about around Ireland, but certainly in Carlow, I know the secondary schools here all visit the primary schools in the last few years, and they have proper structured transition programs and that. I mean, the only thing I don't like in primary level that I hear, and I'm always trying to, it kind of irks me, is the whole idea, similar to you there, is getting ready for secondary. So like, giving them loads of homework for some reason, or you know, or being meaner to them for some you know, you wouldn't get away with that in secondary school now, you know, put your hood down
in secondary school. And then you're kind of setting us up to be really hard and really, you know, and we're really not. Like, I mean, I'm no, it's all about relationships. I do not treat any secondary school child teenager differently than I treat my preschool children or my work colleagues or my own children or my friends.
Yeah.
You know, be kind, be respectful. It's very much about relationships, isn't it?
Yeah. And I actually, to be honest, I think primary schools have gone through a very similar change to secondary schools, as I assume all of society has gone through, that actually, you know, the school that we might have experienced as children is not the same school anymore. It is about relationships. And I think all sectors have embraced that. And, you know, I think maybe sometimes we project what we experience, maybe the 20th century way of teaching at second level. You were afraid of your teacher, all the rest of the, you know, that traditional structure. And that's just, it is gone. I mean, I have never seen it any time I've walked into a secondary school in the last decade or two anyway, where you have that, where I remember going to my secondary school to give one of the teachers was retiring that taught me. And I was so struck by the positivity that, now it was never a negative place for me, but how it changed completely in terms of even the smell of the place, you know, as you know, that kind of thing. It was astounding. Yeah. And
definitely. And you know what, it does strike me as we're talking, I know certainly in the secondary school that I teach, you know, at, we're all basically ladies, you know what I mean, and women and nice, and we just kind of, it's just all like, I can't even explain. It doesn't feel like a really structured school setting. We're just a whole load of women, you know, in there to do a job. And you've got a job whether you're a teacher or a student or, you know, and we all treat each other with respect. And, you know, and it does strike me that, as you say, in the secondary school sector, we have become much more understanding of how the young adult, the teenager, processes things and how they develop. And we're much less structured. And I wonder, is the primary school still very structured in terms of you must line up? And I mean, I know a primary school where they still have to wear slippers.
Yeah, I mean, it's less common now. I mean, I think every sector has loosened up and is more about relationships than these. Yeah, I mean, you'll get these outliers where that, and kids have to line up and put their fingers on their lips for their line, you know, that kind of nonsense. I mean, that I don't think I've seen that for a while. And you know,
yeah, and isn't that great? So what I'm hearing is we're already probably doing quite a good job in terms of these transitions. I think we've come a long way. And I think we just have to keep working really hard at that. And it's just really important that we remember that the key to all of this is not the school, it's the child.
Yeah, yeah, I think so. And I think that's very fair. So let's let's talk about childcare sector and sort of like what's been in the news and the media really recently, because number one, I guess it isn't something that I'm very familiar with. I don't really know how childcare is. I know it's not a public service So I mean, it's a public service, but it's not a public sector; it's a private kind of business. Do you know about the history of how the preschool sector kind of came to not be part of the education system?
Yeah, it's complex, and it all comes down to funding, basically. So, you know, one of the main reasons, I suppose. Look, if you look at the 80s or 90s, very unregulated, you know. Childcare regulations in 1996, and we began to see some formality there, and then amendments in, you know, in the 2000s. You know, they're just, Ireland just didn't have the money, firstly. But also we didn't have, like other countries, we didn't have a huge need for formal childcare because of how we are culturally, or how we were culturally, in that most families had a parent, mainly the mother, stay at home. So there wasn't huge demand until we kind of began to move into, you know, the 1990s, 2000s, and then the economic boom. And then all of a sudden we had all this really big demand for early years. And, you know, it started because women, and it was mainly women, I think 95, 96% of providers are women.
Yeah.
Noticed that there was a problem, basically, that there was a lack of childcare, and they started to invest their money to open services. You know, a lot of them would have started like as childminders in their own homes, and then it developed and grew, and some people invested heavily, and I was one of those people, and, you know, and that's how it basically formed. So it formed because the private sector met a need that was not being met by the government. I mean, a bit similar to pre-1968 and the Donough O'Malley moment, when all of a sudden overnight secondary school education became a public sector. And previous to that, it had been offered by mainly the religious orders. And I always say this, that if it wasn't for, you know, the Dominicans and the presentations, etc., that most women in Ireland probably would have never received an education, you know. Certainly my mother's generation wouldn't have. So a bit like that, you know, except there was no Donough O'Malley moment for the early years sector. It never happened. And here we are today, where the government has at last recognised that this is a huge issue. And not just a huge issue in Ireland, but when you mark us against the rest of Europe, we are at the lowest end of government investment.
Yeah.
So, you know, as you said, it's in the media a lot now, and rightly so. There's lots of reasons that it's in the media and that we're seeing a lot of it. One is that there's a massive shortage of places. So parents are beginning to say, you know, I cannot go back to work. And again, it's affecting women.
Yeah.
I can't go back to work. I'm having to take unpaid maternity, paternity, all of those different kinds of leave, because I can't, nobody will take a baby under a year, you know. And people say to me, why is this? And why is childcare so expensive for adults? And, you know, there's a really, really easy answer. And it's because of lack of government investment. And if government did not invest in primary school or in secondary school in the same way as they are not investing in the early years sector, it would be costing us money to send, well, you know, some people would say it is costing us money, but it would be costing us thousands to send our children to primary school.
Absolutely.
Yeah, lack of government investment.
Yeah, I mean, I was struck because when I was chatting to childcare providers online, that I was struck by, you know, that idea of how so many people have invested their own money into the sector to provide my argument, and I assume I'm not alone in this, would be that it should just become a public sector. And the argument back was, well, if they want to buy out my premises, you know, go for it. And I was struck by the analogies between what's happening at primary level with the churches, who also own pretty much all of the buildings, and they're probably saying the same thing. Well, if you want it to be a public sector, you know, well, you know, buy our land. And the difference, though, I think, is that there's definitely altruism in the early years. This wasn't done because you want to you know, particularly have any control over the children once they left the early year sector. Whereas it could be argued that there was the get them young kind of attitude from the church.
Oh, yeah,
there was an advantage.
Yeah.
There was an advantage to providing education to young people, which is fair enough. I mean, gosh, you know, that's how it works. But that's but it's the similarities are very interesting. And are we walking ourselves into a 21st century version of what happened in the 1920s and 1930s, where the churches basically said, you know what, look, we have these, we have all this land, and we will provide, if the state provide us with some money, we'll provide a service. And mm-hmm. does it look like that's probably what's going to happen, that the government are going to essentially tell you all what you have to do and give you some of the money, you know, in order to run it? Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. then leave the owners.
Yeah, I mean, look, this is already happening. So, you know, I am a preschool only up until the 1st of September this year, when I'm becoming full daycare. But for 20 years, I have been a preschool only, opening term time 3 hours a day. Mm. So not unlike the primary school, just a slightly shorter day. Since 2010, I have been 100% government funded. So I am not allowed to charge fees of any description. I am 100% government funded. In 2010, they brought in the free ECI year.
Yes.
Now, they call it the free ECI year. Providers would say it might be free to parents, but it's provided free to them because providers are making up the difference.
Sure.
So when they brought that in 2010, the capitation that they gave us per child was $64.50 per week.
Wow.
Now, 12 years later, the capitation they give us is €69 per week.
Wow.
So there has been, there's no point in even talking about the increase. It's non-existent, really. And we are still expected to not charge fees for that service. Wages have gone up. Everything has gone up. I spoke to one provider in Talla, funnily enough, who has two services, and she's having to close one of the services because her rent per year is €50,000.
Gosh.
In a community service, in a community centre. They want €1,000 a week offer.
And you can't do that with 60 odd euro a week per child.
You just can't do that with 20. And so we're told how many children we can have. The maximum children you can have is 22. You can't have more than 22, regardless of the size of your room. You're told how many children. The ratio is 1 to 11. Mm-hmm. And then it drops to 1 to 8. And then it drops to 1 to 6, depending on the age of the children.
Sure.
So, you know, legally you can't open, obviously, if you're not in ratios. All of your staff have to have a minimum of level 5. So if somebody rings in sick, you're really in a predicament there.
Mm.
Do you send home half of the children?
Yeah.
But you can't have less than, you can't have one person on the premises on their own.
Yes.
So you have to close. It's really, really, really problematic. So for 12 years, I have been fully government funded. I have no other way to generate income. It doesn't exist for me, but my costs have exponentially gone up. They have risen dramatically. So there is new, just to put a positive spin on it, and so that you understand the European situation. Ireland currently invests, some people say it's 0.2% of GDP. I think it's closer to 0.3% of GDP into the early years sector.
Yeah.
UNICEF recommend 1%. That's a huge difference.
That's nice.
There are the good European countries, you know, who we consider to offer really good early years education. Some of them are investing 1.3% of GDP into the sector. So you can see how, in comparison to some of the Scandinavian countries, we are a whole 1% behind. Now, that mightn't sound like a lot, but when you look at it in the bigger picture, it's huge. Billions.
It's huge.
It's billions, you know. Yeah. So we have this year under the current Minister for Children, who I think, I'm happy to say, I think he is probably, Roderick O'Gorman, being one of our best ministers, if not the best minister. He does seem to understand and really is trying to make a huge difference. Mm. So $220 million has been invested this year in order to increase wages for staff. And that's currently going through a big process. And I'm confident it's all going to happen in September. But still bringing level 5 educators to €13 an hour.
Oh my God. Yeah.
That's what we're looking at.
It's shocking, isn't it?
Rising to €15.50 if you're a graduate and you're a manager.
It's shocking.
Which basically means you probably have 10 years experience.
Yeah.
It's shocking.
It's shocking.
And the reality is, now, you know, just to say, my staff who have been with me many, 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 many years are already on more than the new proposed rates are suggesting because they've been with me for so long. But that's coming out of the profit. So the profit is increasing, which means I can't reinvest. I can't put in that new floor that I looked at yesterday and went, that floor is in crap condition.
Yeah.
I can't because I'm paying it to my staff, and rightly so.
Yeah.
But I shouldn't have that. I shouldn't have that battle. So what I would say is, and there's providers out there who would shoot me down for this, but I'm a small provider, right? I don't claim to be a big provider and to understand there, you know, somebody with 500 children and 100 staff. And that's a whole business thing that I don't even, can't even dream about.
Sure.
I don't think I'd want to, in fact. But I would be inclined to say, either have a Donna O'Malley moment and take over the whole thing, or fund us properly and let us do it. Because we have done a tremendously good job for 20 years.
Absolutely.
Quality in the sector is amazing.
We have, absolutely.
We have upskilled. We have done degrees. We've done masters. You know, our CPD is constant and ongoing. And we do all this in our own time, you know, and out of our own pockets.
Yeah.
We get nothing for any of that. Absolutely nothing. You know, the sector, I mean, and Ashtar is one example of it, is brilliant, absolutely brilliant. Quality is fantastic, and the envy of the rest of Europe.
Wow.
You know, the envy of, I mean, if you look at even our AIM model, access and inclusion model that we have for children with additional needs, that's the envy of Europe.
Is it? That's fascinating to me, because I'm always,
and
I'm always looking, I look at AIM as a kind of a, why do we not have this model in our, in primary education? Like, I find that a, this could bring us into a tangent that could take us an hour, so we won't get into it. But
yeah, we won't go there. Yeah,
how AIM is, seems so good at preschool level, and then a child is then dumped into a, you know, it's like everything they got in preschool is taken away, and off they go to flounder, which is inevitably what happens in 99% of cases, I'd say. But it's interesting to know that it's recognized as a good model, and
should be,
and what we could learn from it. And I mean, I can also only speak as like one dad, let's say, who's had one child through a preschool service, but I also, from someone who's on the same site as a preschool service, and I just I'm in absolute awe of because I know the pay, for example, is awful compared to what people's doing a pretty much equal job, like, you know, and the difference is astounding. So I'm going to ask you, I just want to ask you something, because you mentioned, you know, that either, you know, do a Dun O'Malley thing and make it a public service, or fund it properly. Like, would you, I mean, you're only one person, but would you get a feel that, is that conversation happening? Do you think, what do you think people would do? Or would it be a very polarizing sort of thing to happen?
Yeah, I don't think the conversation is happening. I think the conversation is happening among certain people who would like it to happen, and it's a very idealistic view. I think there's a lot of people maybe in academia who see it as being, of course, this is the way we should go, but, you know, they don't work in the sector on the ground. So first of all, it would take billions to do this, and the government are not going to spend the billions, and why would they when we're doing it for them cheaply?
Absolutely, yeah.
You know, so that's the first thing is the money. The second thing is, there's several things, but, you know, again, I am an early years teacher, and I'm a secondary school teacher, but I'm also a businesswoman, and we are mainly women, and I'm extremely proud of my little business, and I have seven wonderful teachers who work for me, and there is pride in that. And I did that, and my investment over the years is over 200,000.
Sure.
You know, and yes, the government might buy it all off me, and I might end up doing financially better, but I'm not doing it for money anyway.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know what I mean? So there's a huge amount of pride in owning my own business and having something to hand over maybe to the next generation. And my son is now joining the business. So there is also that element of those of us who did embrace this and go into it, we do have that bit of entrepreneurial skill about us. And, you know, as somebody who works in both spheres, if you like, you know, I don't know if I want to give that up.
Yeah, it's very hard if you've got that sort of entrepreneurialism within you.
I don't know how I feel about that.
Yeah, it's a hard thing.
It really is. And then the other thing is, you know, how would it work in a practical sense? And I think very often the primary school sector see us, when they view us, just as being those 3 hours of ECI, you know? But we do way more than that. Like, earlier services are open from 7 a.m. till 7 p.m. offering part-time care, full-time care, after-school care.
Yeah.
And how would that all mix through? And how would staff mix through? And there's an... It's complicated. But I'll tell you the one thing that won't work, and this is the problem in the sector, is that the government continuously make decisions on our behalf and don't bring us into the conversation.
Yep.
And there's no point...
Yeah.
You know, and they're great to bring in the academics with the research.
Yeah.
You know, but you actually need to speak to us.
Yeah.
You know,
it's the people.
We're the
on
ones
ground.
Who are doing it. Yeah. No, I own the building. I heat the building. I painted the building yesterday. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And it's not connected to my house, but it's next door to my house. I'm one of the lucky ones who actually has a separate building.
Right.
And a separate car park and a separate garden. But so many of them are connected to people's homes.
That's right. Yeah. Yeah.
You know, so there's also an emotional tie there. So I don't see it coming down the road in a hurry.
No. It's like most things that have started in education. You wouldn't start from here. If you're going to design the system, and it's how do we unravel what we've done if that's desirable. So it's kind of interesting.
And maybe over time. Maybe over time.
Yeah.
But it will take time.
It will take a lot of time. Absolutely. I have one more question for you because we're coming up to the hour.
Oh my goodness, we're going to bore people.
No, God, you're being asked. The thing that strikes me actually, just before I ask my last questions, is there's so many similarities, you know, with the challenges and the opportunity in preschool as we have in primary school. When you're saying things, we're going, yeah, us too, yeah, you know, that kind of thing. It's amazing. And maybe it isn't amazing. We're not doing anything. We're really not in the same business in a way, doing things slightly differently and all that. But I always ask every person on this show to tell me what they would do if they were given the reins of the Minister for Education. So you're not getting Rodrigo Gorman's job because he's doing a good enough job. You're going to take on Norma Foley's job. He's not doing a great job, in my opinion. But your job would be to take the job off her and to... you have the power to do at least one thing, and it would happen. So if you were the Minister for Education, what is it that you would do? And it doesn't have to be related to early childhood, by the way.
Okay. I've only got one. Okay. I think I'm probably going to come off this now and say, oh, that was a bad one. But I'm going to go with it because it's the first one that came to my head, right? I think I would make it compulsory that all junior and senior infant teachers have a degree in early childhood education.
Oh, I like that. Yeah, I like that. And it wouldn't be unusual, isn't it true? And I may be wrong on this, but I trained in the UK, and at some point in the training we had to divide into early years, or I can't actually remember what the other one was, and it's the one I did.
I know that feeling. I've forgotten most of what I did in college.
Yeah, I can't even remember the name of the course I did. That's terrible. But there was a separation. Whereas, is it true here that we don't do that, do we?
No, we don't tend to. My understanding of primary school training is that it is very based around some of, you know, a lot of the older years, for example. But there is that other route, and my daughter is hoping to start that now. She's already done 1 year in Maynooth, and now she's transferring into the degree in early childhood education. And that's 4 years, and then a 2-year PME. So, so that's the route she's going. And the reason she's taking that route is obviously she has, you know, she's been looking at us and what we do for 21 years, and she really does enjoy that age group. But she wants to work in the public sector because from a career perspective, she really specifically wants to work in junior and senior infants. And I think that is where I would make a slight differentiation. I think I had written it down earlier on. I think junior and senior infant teachers need to have a degree in early childhood education. But I also think Norma Foley needs to introduce a PME. For people with a degree in early childhood education.
That's
and I think maybe we need to have teachers who specialise in infant education. and so I'm not sure if it's the same thing to be actually I know it's not. It is not the same to teach sixth class as it is to teach junior infants. In fact, it's more similar to teach first year and sixth class than it is to teach sixth class and junior infants. They are so far apart.
Absolutely.
I think teachers who are teaching junior infants and senior infants need to have more knowledge about how children of that age group learn, about their development, about learning through play. And I think, you know, that might be a way of us bridging that gap.
Yeah, I fully agree with you. I mean, I we won't have time to talk about it, but I'd love to see a kind of a model where if the sectors were to be combined, that actually we would get rid of junior and senior infants from primary schools and have a whole early years, 0 to 6 kind of thing. And then primary starts in first class like it does like in normal countries.
Yeah, I mean, ASHTER, the childcare regulations cover children 0 to 6.
Yeah.
ASHTER covers children 0 to 6. Why don't we just start primary school education in first class?
Yeah, because it's the first class. You know, even the name would sort of tell you that all you need to know.
I think you're on the same page, Simon.
That's good. It is often that happens sometimes. When people get to talk to each other, that's often there's so many similarities. Yeah. Well, final thing is, where can people find you if they want to learn more about what you do? And hopefully we'll send me on the links to them after so we can put them in our show notes. Where can people find you?
Yeah, so I suppose my main platform for my own work, and if anybody's interested to see how a child-led, play-based, early years classroom, if that's the right word, works, is my Instagram page. And that is Celine_teacher_teacher. And I will share the link with you. excuse me. And I do also then, of course, have the Twitter profile. And that's what I do with Paula Walsh, who is the digital educator. And that's ECE Quality Ireland. And that is a community of practice, basically, where providers, teachers, academics, people from all over Europe come together, and we discuss a different topic every Wednesday, and we also have our podcasts. So they are my two main platforms, and frankly, it's busy enough. I'm not having another one.
Yeah, I get you. Well, listen, thank you so much, Celine, for coming on to this podcast. And the hour flew, and I'm sure we could talk for another hour and keep going. But it's a great flavor for my audience here, mainly primary school teachers, to hear what the similarities and differences of the preschool service and more similarities as one would, I suppose, have hoped between the two sectors. And I thank you so much. For those of you who have forgotten, that I have Celine Govern, who is an early years provider and podcaster working in County Meath. Thanks so much for being on the show, Simon. Celine.
Thank you.
Great stuff. So that is it for this week. Thank you so much for those of you who are listening. If you've enjoyed this podcast, we're on Google Podcasts, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, all the rest of the gang. And please feel free to subscribe to the podcast if you can. If you've enjoyed this episode also, please review it. And that would be much appreciated so other people can find it more easily. And that's it for this week. So thanks so much for listening. All the very best.
So, hello, Paula here again. I really hope you enjoyed that really interesting podcast and discussion between Celine and Simon Lewis on his If I Were the Minister for Education podcast. Tune in again next time for more from the ECE Quality Ireland podcast, which you can find on Podbean, on Apple Podcasts, on Google Podcasts, and various other platforms where you can get your podcasts.